Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the White House visit of Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and speak with Pakistan expert Christine Fair, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She joins us to discuss the strained relations between the United States and Pakistan and concerns that America will abandon Pakistan after its withdrawal from Afghanistan. Then we'll examine the latest display of racist disrespect for the president that occurred in a recent White House meeting when a top House GOP leader told Obama to his face that, "I cannot even stand to look at you." Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington and author of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America, joins us to discuss the disgusting and dangerous level of hatred in American politics. Then finally, we'll have an overview of the economy and an analysis of why the Republicans, having lost the fight over the shutdown and the debt ceiling, are dominating the national conversation over the size of government and the deficit, which a lot of Americans see as our biggest problem, even though it is demonstrably wrong. Justin Wolfers, a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity, joins us to discuss the Republicans' focus on deficits while ignoring the collapse of the middle class and the growing inequality as almost all of the economic gains go to the top 1%. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, Chris. And the Prime Minister of Pakistan at a meeting at the White House, he had breakfast this morning with Vice President Biden. And I take it drones are very much on the agenda, but also economic assistance. The U.S. recently restored more than $1.6 billion in military and economic aid. And in September, the IMF approved a $6.64 billion extension of a loan to Pakistan. But just to start with the economy, Pakistan's economy, are these band-aids ever going to make any ultimate difference in the sense that the Sharif government appears unwilling or unable to take the hard steps and make the choices to structurally turn around the Pakistan economy?
I mean, the short answer is no. I mean, because there are so many fundamental problems with the economy. I mean, you could begin with the tax base, very low collection of income taxes, but perhaps even more pernicious than that is that Pakistani elites just refuse to tax themselves. I mean, believe it or not, they don't have an industrial or an agricultural tax. So what ends up happening is that they keep passing off taxation in the form of general sales tax, which is very regressive and hurts the poor. I mean, we could have discussions of this nature on virtually every aspect of Pakistan's fiscal policy or lack thereof.
So are we going to just be continually asked to apply Band-Aids here? Is that the future?
I mean, I suspect it is, because ultimately what the United States really cares about in the near term is getting out of Afghanistan. And this requires Pakistan's cooperation, of course, both with respect to getting the war material out of Afghanistan back through Pakistan on ships and back to their place of origination or their onward destination. But it also requires Pakistan's help to at least put some sort of a respectable finish on this war so that the Americans don't look totally disgraced. And so we're going to do in the near term whatever it takes to continue to buy Pakistan's cooperation. It's very much like a parking meter. You've got time as long as you keep putting money in. Over the long term, that is to say, beyond 2014 and beyond, Pakistan is going to continue bribing the international community, pointing out how dangerous it is, and to make sure that the international community doesn't simply wash its hands and turn away from Pakistan, or even worse, try to contain it or punish it through punitive sanction regimes for supporting terrorism under nuclear umbrella. It continues to invest in its nuclear program. It's very vocal about pursuing tactical nuclear weapons. It's very vocal about its efforts to combat India's so-called cold start strategy. So basically, Pakistan is going to continue to invest in its assets, which are absolutely hair-raising, and that which will allow it to continue to extract rents and compensation from the international community.
So, in other words, Pakistan is using the fact that they are the fastest-growing nuclear arsenal in the world. They've apparently surpassed the French in total numbers. They're, in effect, using their nuclear arsenal as a form of blackmail to extract aid on the basis of the general concern about the size of their arsenal, the instability of the country, and the possibility of a war with India?
Oh, absolutely. And I would further add, it's able to continue its policy of revisionism towards India because of this nuclear arsenal. And that is to say, Pakistan's completely free to deploy terrorist organizations to attack India, knowing full well that India is very constrained in its ability to respond militarily because of these nuclear weapons. It also forces the United States to intervene in any conflict cycle, which, you know, time and time again, the conflicts are started by Pakistan. So they're pretty much Pakistan's go-to strategy for international coercion as well as for bilateral coercion vis-a-vis India.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fares, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So I take it, though, that both Nawaz Sharif, the Prime Minister, who's meeting at the White House, and Pakistan's ambassador in Washington, they've all suggested that they want their concerns about the U.S. abandoning Pakistan after they withdraw from Afghanistan assuaged.
Oh, I am so sick of hearing this. I really am sick and tired of hearing it. Pakistan continues to you know, bang out this sorry tune on its kazoo, and it's absolutely exhausting. The United States and Pakistan, we are not spouses, we are not lovers, we are not in a pimp-prostitute relationship, as they like to say. We are countries that have very divergent strategic interests. The only reason Pakistan is important to the United States is because it is a menace to international security and to U.S. national security interests. The country that has the most say in whether or not the American public, as embodied by a Congress which is ever wary of Pakistan, the only country that can dictate the terms of this relationship in a positive way going forward is Pakistan. And that is, will Pakistan decide to give up jihad as a tool of foreign policy, which is enabled by its ever-expanding nuclear umbrella? Will Pakistan stop being a primary exporter of Islamist terrorism and quite frankly, remaining a concern of nuclear proliferation? Pakistan is not entitled to the American taxpayers' hard-earned dime. There's no reason why the middle-class Americans should be supporting the average Pakistani when Pakistani elites aren't supporting Pakistanis. So I, you know, whenever I hear this tire-old tune, I call the nonsense flag on it. They are not entitled to our continual support, particularly when, despite the $25-odd billion that we have given them since 9/11, they continue to take those funds, support the Taliban in Afghanistan, who are killing our troops. Now, if the American taxpayer doesn't understand the bloody math that undergirds this relationship, you know, I don't know what to say to them. I mean, I think the time to cut the Pakistanis off, it really came and went a long time ago.
Well, I imagine the U.S. military know this all too well, since they, I don't know what percentage of the casualties come from Pakistan, in the sense that shortly after 9/11, the first UN intervention, the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, effectively routed the Taliban with a very small boots on the ground footprint, and they were basically driven out almost to extinction. And it looks as though Pakistan brought them back, and they've sheltered them, they've supplied them, all of the IEDs that have killed Americans and blown their limbs off. The ANFO comes from Pakistan. I mean, I could go on. There's a litany.
Yep.
So what are they saying? I mean, you know, they've been killing our guys in the sense that they, you know, they've been duplicitous in the worst possible way, and yet they're still trying to extract concessions.
Well, I mean, you said it as well as I can say it. I mean, I, as a taxpayer and as an analyst of the region since 1991, I just find myself exhausted with American policy towards the region. We continue to learn no lessons from this. You know, you and I have been talking about this for years, Ian. I mean, from beginning with the folly of the surge. I mean, I remember having this very discussion with you. And, you know, I said at the time, the surge is ridiculous because what the surge is going to do is increase our dependence upon Pakistan to continue to supply this war when the reason why we can't win this war is in good measure because of Pakistan. And so the problem with American policy from the beginning is that they chose to prosecute a war, and they did choose it. We did have other options available to us after 9/11, but we chose to prosecute a war without reliable allies. Now, you know, this raises, well, what other countries in the region could have we worked with? And I always remind people of Iran. Right after 9/11, Iran was incredibly helpful. The Bonn conference in which Afghanistan's interim constitution was drafted, it was Iran that mentioned democracy. It was Iran that pointed out that democracy wasn't in that constitution. It was Iran that pointed out that both the war on drugs and the war on terror should be reaffirmed in the interim constitution. And of course, what the George Bush administration did was, you know, thanked Iran by including it in the Axis of Evil. We would be in such a different place if we could have found a way to work with Iran instead of basically strapping ourselves to this bomb called Pakistan. But that's what we did instead. We strapped ourselves to this explosive, unreliable country that is taking as much as it can while giving as little as it has to.
Well, and of course, as we withdraw, we pay an enormous bribe or tax or whatever you want to call it to get equipped. to get equipment into Afghanistan via Pakistan. And now, in order to get it out, we have to pay this huge bribe as well. And the Iranians built a road from the Indian Ocean all the way up to Afghanistan, which would be the perfect route. But, you know, we can't talk.
They actually built that road and rail link. So basically, you've got this port in Chabahar that's been developed with Indian assistance. With Indian assistance, they built the rail and road link that connects basically traffic from Chabahar up to the Afghan border, and then a continuing road that then hooks it up and onto the ring road. Now, you know, Americans will howl and squeal at the suggestion that we could have done this through Iran, and I tell them, you know, they can pretty much shove it because Iran only aspires to be the nuclear proliferator and supporter of terrorism that Pakistan is. Iran has done nothing that Pakistan hasn't done orders of magnitude more, and yet we have found a way of shoving $25 billion down the throat of Pakistan while absolutely having no significant backup plan. There was a northern distribution route, but even at its peak, it could carry no more than about one-fifth maximum of the logistic requirement to support the war in Afghanistan. And people forget that because of basically Russian chicanery, we were never allowed to move lethal equipment through the northern distribution route. And, of course, you know, we're fighting a war, right? So that does require us to move lethal things into theater. It's hard to not just be it's hard 12 years into this to be anything less but cynical to such an extreme.
Well, also, in contrast to shoveling money at Pakistan and turning our back on Iran, who's been helpful, we're sanctioning Iran over a nuclear program that they don't have a bomb, where the Pakistanis do, and they may want a nuclear capability, but they don't appear to want a bomb. So that's a peculiar double standard as well.
No, I mean, like I said, I mean, Ian, you and I—actually, you and I met right after this whole war on terror began. And, I mean, this—from the beginning, we had choices. we like to tell ourselves that we didn't. The fact is, American leadership decided to do exactly what you said, which was to basically work with this country that was under, by the way, it was also under the dictatorship, although a dictatorship that was palatable to Washington at the time. It was basically an autocracy run by a general that had seized power in a coup, which is, of course, extra-constitutional. In fact, he committed two acts of treason. It is a well-known proliferator. In fact, that's how Iran got its nuclear technology from Pakistan. And you know, here we were trying to find every possible way to work with Pakistan while during the exact same period trying to find ways of alienating Iran. And I'll tell you what's so frustrating about that, not just from the logistical point of view, but also from the point of view of strategy. Whether Americans want to hear it or not, the Iranians have more in common with us in terms of the outcome that is preferable in Afghanistan than Pakistan. And that's just the way it is. The Iranians were not fans of the Taliban. The Iranians do not want the Taliban back in power if they can avoid it. And in fact, to be completely blunt, though Iran's policies are deeply flawed, its democracy is deeply flawed, in some significant way, the Iranian democracy is much more practiced than the Pakistani democracy. And so, you know, there's going to be a future when Iran is no longer controlled by this current unpalatable regime. And, you know, the Iran that emerges, I think, is going to be much more in a line with our interests than, say, Pakistan. And we were just never able to see that throughout the entire duration of what is now the longest war in American history.
So, Christopher, let's turn to the drone issue, which apparently, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif said on Tuesday that the drone strikes deeply disturb and agitate the Pakistani people, and it's an issue of a major irritant in relations with the U.S. What's your take on that?
Well, okay, so my take on this is two things. I mean, yes, it's true that many Pakistanis are deeply outraged by the drone program, but it is also true that that outrage is absolutely fanned by an elaborate misinformation machine run by the Pakistan military and its PR arm, the IFPR, as well as the media wing of the ISI. Fact. The Pakistanis own the airspace. Fact. They have to deconflict the airspace to accommodate the operation of drones in the various flight boxes to which they are constrained. If you look at a map, I mean, this is very much an airspace through which civilian aircraft would otherwise be traveling. So we can't deconflict Pakistani airspace, right? The drones, they fly at different altitudes, some of which are the same altitude as a civilian aircraft. The Pakistanis have to deconflict that airspace, otherwise there would be accidents all over the place. Fact, the Pakistanis are providing intelligence to enable these drone strikes, which is why they have been so effective. It's also a fact that we are killing Pakistan's terrorists, perhaps more so than we're killing terrorists that generally affect our interests. The reason being, we've simply depleted the high-level al-Qaeda target set. And so we're basically engaging in what is widely known in D.C. as goodwill kills. In other words, we're killing Pakistan's terrorists so that we can continue to operate drone strikes to take out those that are of interest to us. And also, we don't have an interest in Islamist terrorists, you know, rampaging across Pakistan. So, you know, what I find so exhausting are the Ben Emersons howling on about how the drones violate Pakistan's sovereignty and how he will drone on, if you will, about how the parliament has declared this to be a violation of Pakistan's sovereignty. Well, you know, Ben Emerson should clue up. The Pakistan parliament does not control Pakistan's foreign policy. It does not control Pakistan's national security policy. The army controls that. And so when he wants to talk about violation of Pakistan's sovereignty, he needs to take this argument to Pakistan's ISI and to the army headquarters, because that's where this policy is being made. When Amnesty International comes out and lambasts the Americans for not being forthcoming about who we're killing in a covert program, which is, you know, visible that Amnesty would even make such a demand, knowing full well that covert programs don't typically get a point-by-point readout on the public, you know, on the local news channel. It's important to note that at least part of the reason why this program is still covert is that the Pakistanis don't want their hand in this to be revealed. It would be incredibly embarrassing for Pakistanis to know how involved their government is in these drone strikes. That's why this program remains covert, whereas Obama said that other elements of the drone program would be handed over to the DOD and could at least then be clandestine, which is has a less rigorous disclosure policy than things that are covert. So mm-hmm. he can howl and scream all he wants. The fact remains that we know from WikiLeaks that Pakistan's apex political leadership prior to his assuming power agreed to this. He also knows that his army calls the shots, not him. And I think the interesting thing about Nawaz Sharif coming here and talking about drones, in some sense, he feeds right into the hands of the army because he's not going to stop the drones. The drones are going to stop when American interests and Pakistan Army's interests are served. He can howl and scream all he wants about drones. It's not going to change policy, and he knows it. He simply looks as ineffective as the Pakistan Army thinks he is.
Well, just in closing, in the last minute here, I want to get your take on the proliferation of conspiracy theories in Pakistan, how much they affect the bilateral relations. Recently, the vice chancellor of Pakistan's largest university came up with a book that says that the British and American governments are controlled by a high cabal which manipulates each of us by putting microchips in our brains.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you need any comment from me to underscore how absolutely asinine such a supposition is. But look, let's take the Malala. I mean, I think anyone watching the Malala episode, you know, which is the young girl that was shot by the Taliban, the conspiracy theories that have circulated about her are equally ignominious. The conventional wisdom there is that obviously the Taliban could not have shot her because if the Taliban shot her, she would have been dead. Therefore, the CIA must have shot her so that they could orchestrate this entire thing to make Pakistan look bad. I mean, come on. And here's the thing that will just completely blow your mind away. So many Pakistanis believe this rubbish. That's the thing. You know, it's so hard, I think, for folks like myself to reconcile, is that here's a country that has a very well-educated elite, a very wealthy elite. It has nuclear weapons. It has the fifth largest stockpile in the world. And yet, at the same time, it's a country that subscribes to this nonsense. Now, I will point out that very similar parallels can be made about Americans. You know, our ignorance is completely inversely related to our national power. So I think maybe Pakistanis and Americans have more in common than either would like to believe.
Well, Chris Farah, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Have a fabulous day.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're looking into a top House GOP leader's insult to the president, where he said to his face, "I cannot even stand to look at you."